And I was just reading this comment by Neil Avenue, which was, resourcism requires that we think of the world as slaves thought of their human merchandise, that kind of thing. So how, given that we tend to do that, how will we turn around and consider the others that we share the world with? And I guess the question is, well, why should we? You know, that's the first thing people say, well, why? You know, what use is that? Or it's sort of a utility-minded argument. But also perhaps even because we have the ability to wipe out species at a phenomenal rate, perhaps it's incumbent upon us to consider that relationship. Not just as one of power, but as one of participants.
Utility is another one of those words that I think is in contention in a sense. There have been different senses of utility around the place. So,
so
many people use that as a synonym for happiness, more or less, or whatever kind of human good or satisfaction and happiness and pleasure and happiness, whether it may be to do with making more money or getting more food, or it may be to do with having interesting philosophical discussions or aesthetic experiences, appreciating the wilderness. Many people would include all of that in utility. In a philosophical context. But then there's also another sense of the word in which it seems to refer to something that's exploitative or merely fulfilling very basic needs or crude needs or the kind of needs we don't necessarily want to acknowledge as everyone doesn't want to acknowledge as needs, like need for money or more money.
How important do you think are not of the ontological basis for informing our world needs are? My sense is that the Judeo-Christian ontology is one in which humanity and nature were, in a sense, created in a distinct way, and that humanity was given custodianship over, stewardship over, or even dominion over nature, so that there was a wee vague ethos built into the into that idea, and it probably has informed all of our psychology and philosophy in some sense for the last several thousand years. On the other hand, we have a different ontology as voiced by Leva, and also the Greek, my sense of the Greek, certainly the Aurelian, the Michael Aurelian one, is everything is in and of nature. We are all from nature. And interestingly, that came up before the Judeo, well, parallel with the Judeo idea, they sort of grew together, I suppose, from the same root. But what science has done in the last 700 years has shown us that if we had to choose between the two, the older Greek version might be closer to the truth. Every single one of us, every single molecule in our body was forged at the center of the star. You know that. Every single organism on the planet has evolved from a common heritage. So that we are all indeed connected to one another. We know that now, that's fact. So we don't have to look to the Judeo model as, you know, the separate idea of separation. We know something differently. But nonetheless, for example, is the mindset of the industrial complex, which has grown up in a capitalist perspective, been informed in some sense by that older ontology, even though those who voice these things don't even know that anymore, you know, but it does inform. So do we have a responsibility of directing our ideas towards a new ontology, one that is more convergent with what, in fact, we do know about the world.
In my judgment, no, as I said earlier, I think it makes a great deal of difference. You can find within the Christian movement now a reading of this, literal reading of the Bible to be interpreted as stewardship, as responsibility for nature. Whereas in the previous time when there wasn't an environmental concern, it was read as domination over nature. And I think there are communities who live very much, quote, in touch with nature in a very comfortable way for thousands of years, largely as a function of not having the technology to create the kind of mess that we have. Give them the technology, they'll do the same thing. Because of the immediate reinforcement of getting the goods, growing crops that are sweet, growing more tobacco, being able to make foods, getting cars that will go faster, given the technology, and they'll do it. And our reading of the ontology, the fitting of the values to the ontology, will follow
what we are being driven by out here in the real realm of living today.
So you're saying we're being driven by greed, almost exclusively?
By greed? No. I think as soon as you say that, you put ideas to the foreground in a way in which people who take Marx seriously would say, you know, all of this comes from the reality in which you live every day, in which you make your living and buy into other people and make decisions about what's going to make you happy. And then your ideology lines up with that. And we have been all been, you know, raised in a world of productivity and advancement.
Well, there's other things going on in the world historically, and for over 100 years now, there's been a general social project of moral expansionism, whereby the things to whom we ascribe value, the circle has widened from white men to include women and people of other races and homosexuals, and, you know, by somewhere in the maybe 70s or 80s, it included all of humanity, most places, right? And I think in many ways the environmental project is about continuing the expansion, continuing to widen the circle of things that have value. And the way we got to this expansionist project in the first place was by empathy, basically. This is another person, they're like me, they have interests like me. I have value, therefore they should have value. And why can't we use the same kind of reasoning to expand the circle? I mean, most of us have great empathy for charismatic megafauna, like dolphins and tigers and polar bears, and it would be a very, very sad day if any of these species were to go extinct. There, the expansionist project is already underway. I mean, when we get further away from the things that are from us, toward mosquitoes and things, it's perhaps more difficult. But we're moving in that direction, and I think the basis for it is quite simply empathy. And personally, I think it's worth pursuing this project, because if what's doing the work, for example, in Gore's film is not this kind of value, it's quite simply self-interest. That if we don't take action, then our lifestyle, the consequences of modern industrial capitalism are going to wipe us out eventually, potentially, or at least make life unlivable for a vast majority of the planet. That's why we should take action, not because there are other species that deserve the same kind of moral consideration that we've been giving to ourselves, but because it's in our interest to take action to protect the environment. And I just think it's the right thing to do to pursue the other project, to look for ways of expanding the circle. Because effectively, if I always look to say, well, what if it turned out that climate change wasn't a problem? Well, then we could simply revert to our old circle, whereby it was basically just humans that deserved our moral consideration. And I don't think that is... Personally, I think that that's not the place I want to be, ethically.
Derek, can I ask you... I'm fairly sympathetic to the idea of extending empathy beyond human beings, and one reason I'm a vegetarian, so... Mm-hmm. But is there no... Is there a limit to that expansion? You know, I mean, at what point is it not possible to feel empathy with another entity, mm-hmm. whatever thing, because that thing perhaps doesn't have any feelings to... I mean, empathy is ability to feel the same way or to share feelings or to appreciate the feelings of another, right? So, in a feeling way. So, I mean, can I have empathy with a pen? Mm-hmm. It would be tough for me.
Sure.
Mosquitoes, I'm not... Yeah, a bit of a borderline there.
Yeah, sure.
The mosquito.
Shrimp.
Well, we were talking about shrimp early, because we were having shrimp, we were eating shrimp cakes, and I was concerned about whether
they were farmed or...
Whether they had feelings, and then Bill told me that he had shrimp that got to know him so well, that when he put his finger in the water or the tank, or I'm not sure what they were kept in, they would come and sit on his finger.
The shift from thinking of us being in dominion to having a custodial
relationship, to a stewardship relationship. Those are all kind of, you know, they're just gradations. We're always kind of above in that. And I think the shift that we need is to kind of understand that, you know, we're recipients. You know, that you know, the earth is there as a gift. Yeah, from whom, you know, we don't even need to get into that, but it's, you know, everything we have and get or might get, it's a gift. You know, we don't deserve it in any way. We're just really fortunate.
Well, that's the gift is the key element of reciprocity, right?
Yeah.
And it's also about striking the balance. As Levi was explaining to us, you know, by making an offering of eagle down before you take a tree, you always give something to receive something. And I think that's a kind of ethics that's consistent with eating meat. The whale hunter had to wait until the whale would give himself to the hunter in a dream before taking a whale. It could take months for that to happen. And there are any number of ways culturally to embody these kinds of values. And they exist in the world around us. One place we can learn them is from other cultures that haven't lost them and have been trying to teach them to our culture for some time. But I don't, like we were talking about this morning, I don't know that these are the kinds of beliefs that can be argued for. I don't know that there's a good argument as to why you should accept these beliefs. Other cultures don't acquire them because as little kids they're persuaded. It's more that this is the culture that they come up with. These are the values of the culture. So where do you get them if you don't have them?
I don't believe one can have empathy with a natural process, because empathy involves sharing feelings with something. Okay, so natural processes I don't believe have feelings. I can certainly have concern for the preservation of that process. I can desire with all my heart for it to continue going and so on. I'm not grounding it in a feeling that it has, which I wish to respect. You know, and that's it. That's different from when I empathize with a human being or even with an animal. When I'm trying to want to protect that animal because I know it has feelings and it may be fearful in certain situations or whatever, you know, it may suffer pain, I want to prevent that suffering. So it's a different kind of rationale for wanting to protect or preserve something. We're not trying to protect natural processes because they may be in pain, or they may feel a pain. We're trying to protect them because they're important and because they have value in some sense, but the value has to be grounded somewhere else outside of their feelings, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And reciprocity, again, what is it to live in reciprocity? Is it any, if I do eat a chicken, does chicken feel better about that if I give something back to, not to what? I can't give anything back to the chicken, can I? I'm not sure.
The way Levi explained to us is, you know, eating a salmon and putting the bones back in the water. Okay, that's one way of eating a salmon. Another way is to buy a farm salmon from Safeway and eat that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference? I mean, personally, my issue with fish farming comes from a movie I saw called Saltwater People, in which a Coast Salish man was speaking about fish farming, and he just looked at the camera and he said, "We are the fish. We are the salmon." And I don't understand that fully. But I understand that there is an identification relationship, an identity relationship that many indigenous people have with totemic animals, with an animal with which they are associated. And by saying we are the salmon, he was saying that the fate of the salmon is the fate of my people. Mm-hmm. The salmon are an other, and we identify with them. And the salmon, they have a purpose in life too. They have to swim across to Japan and eat shrimp, and then swim back to their home river and spawn. And it makes a difference to them, and therefore to me, whether they're able to do that or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's the basis. I think fish farming is wrong because it doesn't treat fish as others. it deprives them of their purpose in life, of their telos, of their mm-hmm. ability to evolve in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this is an argument that I can't articulate in a place like Tofino. People mm-hmm. don't get it. But mm-hmm. I can articulate it in this room because mm-hmm. we share these kinds of sympathies. Not necessarily empathy, but sympathy mm-hmm. and a feeling of reciprocity. So there, I think, that between those two shaman dinners, there is a difference.
You can live one way out here and have one of those salmon dinners, you know, a lot. But if you're living in Vancouver or Des Moines or Albuquerque, you can't. Maybe the frozen farm salmon is what you're going to have to eat if you want to get some of the
omega-3s,
and if you've been persuaded that that's the thing to do. So I think, you know, in a way you have to move away from universalities into certain kinds of specific things. And, you know, we have lots of benefits to living out here. We have disadvantages. You know, we depend a lot on the city. You know, I bet everybody here has used a computer within the last 2 weeks. No, those computers are not made in rural communities.
Mm-hmm.
They're not designed by people living in rural communities. So that interdependency, I think, is something that for us to keep in mind in the conversation.
First of all, I want to, again, help us to keep in mind that this is aimed at that item on the beginning of the headline, mm-hmm. where we have dispute over environmental issues.
Mm-hmm.
A logging shed is or is not about to be logged, etc. And in these situations, you have people sitting around a table making a decision. Those decisions are made largely by, if you think of environmental issues as sort of upfront, there's the policy issues talking about what's going to happen in the long run, and then there's a kind of intermediate issues of setting up regulations like land use zoning plans. And at the bottom, there's the problems of implementing them, getting people to actually follow these things and bring them down to the day-to-day level. But with all of these things, in the middle, you find this issue, in fact, migrating up and down the chart here, the issue of an environmental dispute. And essentially, more and more these days, those issues are decided by bargaining. By bargaining and something like mediation, but essentially bargaining. And I think the question, one question relative to values is what kind of value issues can you bring to bear? What kind of values can you bring in and weigh and balance and compare? And when I think about valuing, I think divide things up in this way, in values, I think of extrinsic values. So you think of something like this cup. To say that it has an extrinsic value is to say it's good for something outside the cup. So here, the sun has an extrinsic value because you can grow crops. Crops have an extrinsic value because they can be used to produce food. And food has an extrinsic value because it's good for sustaining life. What is life good for? Well, at that point you say life just is intrinsically valuable. You may not. You may want to say something else. It helps you to honor God. God has intrinsic value. So something has intrinsic value insofar as we recognize its value without saying, oh, it's valuable for something else. It's just value in itself. This is not something completely remote. And I think about it, not with this kid, you see, but with my older kid going to the beach and picking up a little piece of root off the beach. And he likes it.
Mm-hmm.
He values it. What's it for? Don't even ask him. It's his stick, and he likes it. And he packs it around and he puts it in his pocket, and maybe a few days later, you know, it's out of his life. But at that point, I mean, he may have grabbed a stick to play a game with or to build a fort or whatever, but this particular stick, he just likes it. He just values it for itself, not for anything else. So, to some extent, some of us recognize extrinsic value, certain things in nature. We value not for anything else. We just think they're great. The way they are. That's a distinct issue for from another term which is used, which is something like inherent worth. And this is a question which points to the issue of something having value and asking where does it come from? Okay. So I can say that this thing has intrinsic value, or I can say it has extrinsic values. In both cases, it's having a value, the case of my kid on the stick on the beach. The source of that value is the human being doing the valuing of the object. And its value, whether it's extrinsic or intrinsic, comes from the human being. To say that it has inherent worth or inherent value is to say that it has value quite separate from any valuation activity of human beings. Now, somebody sitting down at a bargaining table may want to say, look, what's going on wrong with the world up to this point is that you people doing your bargaining have simply failed to recognize that there are certain objects there in nature that have inherent value. It's not for us to give them their value or to take it away or to assign it. It doesn't mean you can escape the business of attribution, because we still have to make the judgment that certain things do have intrinsic value if we judge that they do. Or inherent worth. There's still going to be issues of judgment. And I think there's always going to be disputes, not only issues, and remember, the disputes are not only going to be over issues of judgment with respect to value, but also in science with respect to, does the data actually substantiate the claim here? In logic, in economics, there's going to be dispute, because people are going to say, we want a decision made on the basis of my judgment. My judgment may not be a value judgment at all. It may be a scientific judgment. It may be a significant data judgment. So that doesn't make, what I'm getting at here now is that values aren't something nebulous in the way in which other kinds of judgments are. So when you talk about value, does this fit? When you think of objects in nature having aesthetic value, are you meaning that they have some value quite separate from human valuation that we should recognize? So I can, and this is consistent with Levi's view. So, you know, I see the tree there and I say, wow, this is a wonderful tree. Here's the eagle feather, give me the chainsaw. Right? Because I have to recognize your value. I do, I recognize the value and I thank you, God, for this tree. Mm-hmm. Now get the bloody thing out of here and let's get on to the next one. I'm not sure what follows again, and I think you have a hope that recognizing these values will make a difference, but tell me how you think it will.
Well, I think you wouldn't get on to the next one. I mean, part of recognizing the intrinsic value of others and all the trees in the forest and wildlife mm-hmm. there is you treat it differently. Mm-hmm. Then you balance it with your other values. You value the fire that warms your house, and that's why you need the wood from the tree. And it's reasonable to take some fuel, some resources from the mm-hmm. from the forest in order to survive. All of us do this, and all animals do this as well. But recognizing that there is intrinsic value out there means that we balance that value with our own values and needs. And that's something that can happen both on an individual level and at the level of a society, where we form policy based on, you know, our collective needs and relationships to the resources that sustain us.
Can you expand what you mean by balancing values? I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, balance, of course, is at the heart of the concept of reciprocity, and it's why we give in order to receive, is to constantly remind us. And I think train us. And a lot of the concepts that I've been pushing are my attempts to insert virtue ethics into the conversation. So that we're not just operating on utilitarianism, which is the dominant ethics of our society, with a bit of Kantian deontological ethics in there as well from our Catholic heritage, and because they make sense. But there's almost no role of virtue ethics, and that is the way that our actions in the world should be determined not by the consequences, and not by even the nature of the acts themselves, as Kantian ethics, but by the nature of the actor, the agent, the kind of people that we are or want to be. So the things we do, and I think virtue ethics is a strong component of many indigenous cultures and their ways of being in the world. We talk about this. if you listen to them, they'll talk about their family crests and how this is how they know how to behave in the world. They talk about their elders because the elders teach them how to behave in the world. What we do in the world is not a function of what we want to get, but who we want to become. And so the virtues such as moderation that George has been speaking of, and others from the Aristotelian tradition of virtue ethics, are part of who we want to become. This balance is a sense of understanding one's own relationships and respecting reciprocity in our actions in the world. So we're cultivating this balance in ourselves as a way of essentially walking the golden mean.
I'd like to answer Jim in terms, I think, which are different from yours, Derek, but which I think are loyal to yours in a way, right? So if a tree has no inherent worth, then it cannot outweigh any other. I mean, you might say if you're considering what to do in a particular situation, you want to achieve, even in the utilitarian sense, the best outcome, the greatest satisfaction of needs and so on, then that has zero effect. It has zero weight in the balance, if you like. Think about weighing considerations, balance in that sense. Whereas if you allow, and it's true that allowing it some weight by saying yes, it does have inherent worth, doesn't mean that it's going to outweigh some other consideration. So a human need or might easily outweigh it in a single case, but it allows it to have weight in the balance, even if on a particular occasion it's outweighed. So that some number of trees, and that's how it sets a limit on the satisfaction of human needs, is that once you have enough trees in consideration on that side of the, with their inherent worth on one side of the balance against the human need that exists, at some point the balance will tip, can tip the other way. So, I mean, it's just a question of allowing it to have some weight in the argument, right, in the balance of considerations, maybe, entirely for it.
Most people would agree with Jim more than would agree with me. And I'm wondering what we do with our goals with respect to this conversation. Is it worth trying to persuade people to the intrinsic value of wildlife and wild places? Or do we work on the instrumental value of wilderness for the preservation of the climate, for example?
No. I don't think that works, because there's always going to be somebody with a better argument. If you go down that road, there's always going to be somebody with a better argument about why we should. We're always going to be up against something where we're going to be able to justify doing whatever on those terms. One of the things that I think is disturbing about those kind of conversations and those kind of that way of valuing is that they really leave out even human, specifically human cultures, like First Nations cultures,
yeah,
that hold different values and inherent values and different ways of being. And the fact that those values need to be heard at the table that you were speaking about earlier. The particularly nasty thing here, and you speaking about valuing humans, is that we force people who have those values to work by ours. And that's a problem. So right there, even in strictly human terms, is an argument for the inclusion of those values.
When they do walking plans these days, they always do a values. You know, they apply values to the forest, and they have viewscapes, and they have biodiversity values, and they have corridor values, and they assign numerical values. They always seem to come up that it adds up to an argument that we better log this.
Right.
I've never seen any of those value analyses say we better stop.
That's because they cleverly overlay all of various values in one area of the forest. We'll put the biodiversity area here and the Marble Mural Conservation Area here, as well as the large hemlock area here, and at least these other areas where they can be logging and manipulate the values. That's
so the next question on the list is, does management enhance or undermine the value of pristine wilderness? Yeah, I think, let's keep coming back to the notion that we can't leave every place alone, but we can leave some places alone, and that makes us better. If we can leave some things alone, it somehow makes us better.
I disagree, George. I think it's an interesting, I really like Jim's story about the people in the Cowichan Valley who wanted to do something to manage their bit of wilderness, and they were told basically what they should do is nothing.
Yeah.
And they were very uncomfortable with that.
Disappointed. Yeah.
Well, to me, management has always been not about wilderness or wild things, it's about humans. Mm-hmm. And I've always despised parks because they represent the fact that humans are unable to take care of the wild places unless they leave them alone. It's an admission of our failure to relate to the natural world in a morally sound way, that we have to leave parts of it explicitly alone. I believe more in the First Nations approach, that you treat every place with respect. And you don't need to separate any of them out and call them parks where you don't do anything, because they're all treated with respect.
Mm-hmm. Hey. I'm beginning to find this conversation more and more unreal. I started to think when a few moves ago about the Han Chinese. And this little corner of the world is already relatively well protected. Whatever happens in this region.
Sorry, you mean here or the Hong Chinese?
No, here. Some bits of so-called pristine wilderness are actually going to be preserved in some fashion on western Vancouver Island, at least for some time. The forestry industry here is only one part of the global forest industry, and we know that in Borneo and in the Amazon increasingly, and West Africa, tropical forests are being destroyed, not just by Western companies, but also by Chinese and Japanese companies. And this goes back, the point I want to make now goes back to one of Jim's points. Countries where Buddhism has been powerfully influential, both Japan and China. I don't know what the kind of inherent value on life might be there within, say, a Confucian tradition, which is another tradition in China. I understand that inherent value is placed within the Buddhist tradition. It's not very noticeable that those valuations are having very much effect on the development of the Chinese economy right now, which has global reach and global impact. So again, this brings me back to the idea that, well, yes, we can have a shift of values. Yes, we can introduce other things into the conversation, but that's not necessarily going to change fundamentally the way things are being done, unless you can enter into the conversation with people where they are, mm-hmm. In terms of the activities in which they're engaged. I take Derek's point about the discussions here in Clackwood Sound, that it's very, very difficult to put anything about inherent value on the table without it being swept aside or taken up. And I think it's important to try to do that. And here I'm going to write a line, I may contradict myself. One of the tragedies at the moment in this part of the world is that the people who most successfully talk about values are Christian evangelicals who are most concerned about sexual mores and don't seem to give a damn about anything else. And this is a really screwed up kind of values conversation. So insofar as other people can open it up and get other kinds of values on the table and suggest to people that if you want to have a values conversation, talk seriously about a whole range of other values except for your 16-year-old girl is sleeping with. On the other hand, I mean, one can open it up a bit in that regard, but to go back to my earlier point, it still seems to me that that kind of conversation is only going to get you so far, unless you can bite into people's way of life in a way that actually is going to make them change. Mm-hmm. Because it's so easy to acknowledge one's values and then turn around in a split second and make a decision that makes those values.
This is reminding me of a project. I mentioned it last night, just kind of in casual conversation around the fire. A woman named Betsy Damon, who's an American artist, was asked to go and do some work in China. And she was working on the Funan River system, which at one point in the history of China, the city there had been the producer of the finest silk, and it was said that the silk from that region had been the most white and the most pure because it was washed in the Funan River system. So what she initially did to start this project off was she had women wash meters of silk in the river, and the longer they washed, the dirtier the silk became. And Chinese television picked this up and repeated it broadcast after broadcast after broadcast, and people were appalled. Now what had originally brought this to her attention was the fact that school children were upset because they could no longer swim in the river, and fishermen who within their lifetimes had seen the river go from a place that they had a dwelling reciprocity with to a toxic sink were just appalled. So what happened was the regional government came to her and said, we want to work with you to do something about this. So they commissioned her to do this project, and she developed a 5-hectare sculpture water park, which actually cleans the water of the river as the water moves through it. And her comment, what I was getting to, was first it gave people the experience of that change happening. And that was very close to their hearts. And the second thing I want to say is that Betsy Damon commented that she couldn't have done that project in North America because she couldn't have got the government on side as quickly and as readily as she could in China. They just did it. And so things can shift really quickly. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And the other thing I wanted to say in thinking about what people have just been saying is to return to that notion of the experience and dwelling. And when corporate multinationals come in, as you're saying, and log one place, they don't have any investment in that place. They don't have any relationship with that place. They don't have any sense of connection to that place. They're just doing what they do. So where somebody in China might be really upset because they're living on a river and they can't drink and swim and eat fish anymore, they're not going to be as upset about logging in Siberia because they don't have an embodied experience of Siberia. So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the fact that people in North America don't know what a tiger looks like in the wild, or are buying wood from, are buying teak from endangered forests. I mean, how do you create a sense of that relationship and responsibility?
My understanding here in British Columbia from my biologist friends working in forestry, for instance, is that the bigger the logging company, the more likely they are to be environmentally responsible and the less problems involved in policing.
That's really true. And an interesting thing is that the protests in 92 and 93 did not cause the logging companies to change their tune at all. Mm-hmm. And did not cause the government to concede anything to the protesters. What changed things was that the environmentalists realized that this is what was happening, mm-hmm. got together and thought about it pretty hard, and there were some pretty bright lights in the room, and they figured out that the only thing that was actually going to work would be a markets campaign. And they went internationally, went to Europe and Japan. They went to the buyers of the wood products, and they said, this is what it costs to produce this commodity that we're purchasing. And the buyer said, whoa. We don't want to be involved in this, mm-hmm. and they started canceling contracts. Mm-hmm. That brought the corporations to the table. And I think this is an interesting point, because in addition to the comments that Warren's made, the deforestation elsewhere in the world, most of what's motivating people to behave, to act the way they do in the world, is their own economic necessities. They're paying their mortgage, so to speak. In other places, they're simply feeding themselves and their families. And they will do this. They will do what it takes to feed their families. And as you all know, we don't need to go into the full explanation of this. Much of the economic reality in other parts of the world is determined by the economic conditions imposed on them by the first world. We're connected to their economic realities and to the decisions that they're forced to make. And our economic demands are generating their economic supply and their relationships to their environment and so forth. They won't change the way they behave unless these relationships change. They can't. No one is going to stop feeding their family based on some notion of environmental value that comes from elsewhere. The only way they'll do it is if they can. The only way they'll change their behavior is if there's another option, another way for them to survive and feed their family.
I think you were discussing, you're connected with this point that Warren earlier, and that is that a lot of these arguments have been won about the sort of question of what you put into place. And if we ask this question, a number of related questions, well, what kind of progress has been made in the whole environmental concern? I think there has been some progress. And I think one thing that you can see on all sides of the argument is now there's a default position. The default position is the one that those people were unhappy with at Duncan, and that is that the environment, basically, it's okay the way it is, and if we're going to do something different, then the onus is upon anybody who wants to do something different to justify it. And I think that 50 years ago, there wasn't any need for people to justify, you want to cut the trees down? Cut them down. You don't have to justify it in terms of the environment. Now you do. And I think that that does, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think that does feed into environmental political decision making. They at least have to go through the motions. You somehow see it sometimes as going through the motion, laying these templates for evaluation, of justifying their action against that default position. The environment counts, don't screw it up. And if you are, there better be some benefit coming out of it. So what values are now there that weren't there before?
I think there are a whole lot of other reasons why people are very upset about this particular topic, and I think they're probably similar to the reasons people are concerned about forestry. Mm-hmm. And they're getting addressed now, but not to the extent, by any means to the extent, that the scientific natural sciences are being involved. So we can study sea lice for another $10 million, and we may or may not come to any understanding whether they ever were a problem. But no one's really addressing the community. No one so far is really seriously addressing the community concerns, all the different layers of what the community, how they are affected by salmon farms, benefited or not benefited, or put into a worse condition than they were before. I think that's the key area. And I guess one of my questions is it appropriate to talk about intrinsic values? Or are we talking about ecosystem services? Because it's very common these days for people to be talking about ecosystem services. This is why we should be careful. Because otherwise we'll have a problem for ourselves. But then I think a lot of people feel very differently about the ecosystem, not just as an ecosystem service. And do we take that into account?
What do you mean they feel differently?
They feel the ecosystems, the surroundings, they're part of the surroundings, all one, their intrinsic values. And how do you deal with those?
So one way of looking at the situation at Fort Hardy, and
Port Hardy, Port McNeil, and the whack of fish farms in there, is to say, look, we have these fish farms, and we're getting X amount of benefit in terms of dollars, yeah. but it's costing us this much in reduction of wild salmon stocks. And do the cost-benefit analysis and say, well, we're better off. Another way would be to say, there was some kind of natural environment here that we valued, and now it's destroyed. It's changed radically. I don't really give a shit about what the costs were. That environment has been changed radically,
yeah.
and you say we're making $8 million a year here, and so it's worth it. And I say, no, it isn't.
Yeah.
And you say, well, measure it. Give me a dollar value. And I say, well, we can't do that. So you say, I win.
That's wrong.
That's reality. That's wrong. That was absolutely wrong.
Tell me why that's wrong.
Because it's evil. It seems to be instrumental reasoning when you use that way, from the Holocaust to the slaughter of the forests. You know, we just do it for our communities. There's no intrinsic values anymore. We're skirting them. God dies, we skirt them, we don't listen to our Aboriginal wisdom, we don't listen to... I listen around this table, every time the word Christianity comes up, it's said in a quasi-pejorative way, as if Christianity has come to mean what televangelists have distorted Christianity into being. I mean, here's a tradition of 2,000 years of intellectual enlightenment behind it, and I mean, I grew up in a Catholic environment, and I heard nothing but, over the, you know, 60 years of my life, this incredible wash of very, very careful thinking about what value was about, what wisdom, justice, courage, moderation, on, and that's what your life ought to be about, Russell. You know, sure, they said a lot of dumb things about interpreting it here and there, but basically, the bottom line, there's a lot of smart people in the Christian world, in the Jewish world, in the religious worlds around us. We're ignoring those people, we're ignoring that tradition. We're pushing them aside, we push the Aboriginal peoples aside, because we're all pussyfooting around everything, because you say, you have your value, I have my value, you can have your value, you know, just as long as you don't stomp on me, and we'll go to instrumental reasoning, because that'll get everything fixed. No, we need a value, we need a set of values that we all agree to, and we have to get real hard-nosed about it and come up with a need of mythology. You know, the Greeks got by having mythology with things like excellence, nobility, you know, the whole set of things that guided their project for a really long time. And
but Russell, neither Dostoevsky nor classics show that those kind of values were either necessary nor were they sufficient to make for a good world. In fact, there's lots of evidence that good Christians did bad things.
But you're evaluating ethics using utilitarianism. Presupposes the outcome. You're saying, well, all those years of ethics didn't have the right results.
And you value virtue ethics using utilitarianism. You think it'd be a better world.
No, I engaged in virtue ethics.
You think virtue
that's
ethics
not why, that's not why
will get it. You to be a better person. We'll get other pieces. And that's what you're going to get out of it by practicing virtue ethics. You can't escape it. That's what morality is all about. It's about being utilitarian.
No, I don't agree. I think it's worth trying to live virtuously. I don't claim to live by any high standards or anything, but I think even if climate change is inevitable, I was talking about this with these two before, even if we're headed for disaster, it's still worth living well. I still think it's worth living well, even if the consequences are a nightmare. Even if we know that in 50 years sea levels will rise and we're basically toast, I still think it's worth, maybe that's just my nature as a philosopher, I still want to figure these things out, and I would still advocate for policies that are based on virtues and in balance with other ethical traditions, for sure. I just would like to see some role for virtue ethics in the debate,
for sure.
And for these things to have value, and not just with respect to the environment. I think these kinds of ethics should also be applied to all kinds of decisions about in the human world, about what kinds of work people do. And people, we're willing to subject other humans to dreadful work conditions in order that we can enjoy certain kinds of things, that many of which are luxuries. And I think it's wrong, and I think it's wrong on the basis, not of utilitarianism, but on the basis of virtue ethics, because it's wrong to treat people this way. It's wrong for people to have to live this way. It's wrong for them.
But hang on, Bill has asked a question here, and I think Russell's answer is perhaps in the right direction, but it's still a question begging one.
Can I go back to Russell's I don't want to divert this, but what if I said, actually, I see that area as a perfect example of a beautiful area and with all kinds of intrinsic values. I can't justify them, but that's how I see it. And whether or not I think salmon farms fit in, or whether or not I think they actually have any negative effects, set that aside. But what if I told you I could turn this into a Tuscany, or it's going to be turned into a Tuscany, and it's going to change, as you said. So there won't be as many salmon, won't be as many clams, but there'll be a whole lot of other things, and it'll be an idyllic world, I've never been to Tuscany, but like a Tuscany type world. Mm-hmm. Would that be evil? And how do we decide?
Well, it seems to me those kinds of decisions are made for the right reason and the right way, and there's a balance there. You know? I mean, I remember visiting Merv Wilkins' place years ago in 1993 and watching what was done there and how consideration was given to working in cooperation with the environment that was there. I mean, he was harnessing the viruses or the fungi and the mini ecosystems all around that little fairly small acreage in order to, and here it was like 30 years on. Had he been logging that place for 30, 40 years or longer? And it looked, it had a pristine feel, it had a natural feel to it. And that's sort of what Tuscany has been. And that's, you know, I wouldn't call that easy.
I think the kind of ways of being in the world that produce places like Tuscany are really different. I don't think you can plan a Tuscany. I lived for some time quite happily in the south of France, where one of the things that people would do, these very old hill villages, is they'd think about how natural systems worked and work within those natural systems. So that when you have hill villages, you take the limestone, and when it's wet and it's in the earth, it's very soft, and you take it out, you carve it out, and that becomes your cold storage, your cave, and you take the blocks and you build up, and the blocks are really thick and strong, and so it stays cool inside in the summer and holds the heat in the winter. And just you know, the ways that people would work within the land. And even when I lived there in the early 90s, talking with the farmers, they would still follow these complete rhythm of the seasons, and they would still be living in this incredible intimate relationship with this land that their family had been. They dwell in this place. It is not the environment. There is no sense of the environment as something that is out there that is to be managed. They're living, their environment, they're living within. That's how places like Tuscany and Provence and the Languedoc evolve. You know, places evolve, and they evolve within relationships of reciprocity. That's what happens. I don't think you can plan a Tuscany. I can't say, I can tell you that, you know, I'm going to make this place look like Tuscany, damn it.
So
I don't think the kind of thinking that says that is going to produce Tuscany.
Yeah, I've seen a big ad for a new subdivision just north of Victoria.
You're talking about appearances, you're talking about relationships.
I believe in the human instrument. I mean, human reasoning can come up with the brilliant ways of dealing with problem solving. It's just what are the values that are using. Are they strictly economic? Strictly bottom line, and strictly what's good for General Motors is good for, you know, we'll just make it work the way it ought to work for the maximum number of people and maximize their salaries. Or they can be based on a set of intrinsic values that are the base, but the first things one considers, how can we preserve what is best about this system, and how can we integrate ourselves into that system in a reciprocal way? We've done that in Tuscany and other places. We've done that in beautiful ways. Let's continue to do that.
That's what people do, though. I think by virtue of being a human being, you automatically, because you have a physical body that has to be somewhere, you automatically have a relationship with a place. What I think I'm hearing here is undertones of that there are forces in the world at large that don't have that physical relationship with a place. And I'm thinking corporations and governments, which are not place-based. I mean, they are located somewhere, but there's no sort of physical relationship there.
And you alluded to the fact that a value system changed when, not when people were arguing values, but when they went to markets and let the markets know what the true cost of that was. And I'm thinking maybe the way to address, to change this to address the question on the front of this is not to talk about individual human values, but to talk about how to influence the values of those disembodied entities that are making the big decisions. Maybe that's the way to break through the blockade of, you know, you and me in the same room going over the same stuff again and again and never making any progress.
Attributing intrinsic value to the salmon, that is, a magnificent species, no longer exists. Each fish biologists tell us that the salmon from each river are slightly genetically distinct from those of another river. And there's a bit of evolution that's gone, a bit of evolutionary history, and an ecological niche. Another argument comes from ecological service provided by the salmon to through their life cycle, is they're consumed by eagles and bears and distributed to the forest, where nitrogen from the fish fertilizes the trees and actually supports the entire forest ecosystem. A third argument comes from sustainability, and the beauty of the wild salmon is that they go across the ocean and they bring back nutrients from the shrimp and krill that they eat. And all we have to do is sit here at the river mouths like the native people did and take them, hopefully in some reciprocal relationship, as opposed to the situation with salmon farming where the feed is harvested elsewhere, often at the expense of the fisheries of the people who live in those areas, which are usually not first world areas. And so all of their ocean biomass is removed, and at considerable energy expense is processed into fish food and then trucked to the location of fish farms. And so from an energy perspective, it's far more efficient to sustainably manage wild, or management by manage, I mean manage ourselves, in our consumption of wild fish, as opposed to replacing them with far more energy intensive and unsustainable forms of aquaculture. So I think we made a huge mistake when we wiped out salmon stocks to the point where we couldn't sustain ourselves based on our consumption of them and the fish farming. And only one of those arguments is based on intrinsic value.